see if I can get this thing screwed up just about right. My name is Charlie Parman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't found necessary to take a drink for 6,980 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. And it sure is good to be here and be able to do a weekend thing again about the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife Barbara told me when we came up here the other day, she said, "Charlie, when you get up there and you start talking to those people," she said, "for God's sake, talk about spirituality rather than sex." And I said, "Barbara, I don't know anything that's any more spiritual than sex." And I spent the first 50 years of my life praying I could do it twice. And I've spent the last 10 praying I could do it once. I don't understand anything any more spiritual than that. Harold told us before we started tonight that we were going to have to hold this to about 30 minutes apiece. And I don't think he realizes how hard that is for us to do. Because usually when we talk for 12 hours. And cutting from 12 hours to 30 minutes is going to be rather difficult. But we'll do a little bit anyhow. Joe and I have been hearing ourselves here lately described as AA fundamentalist. I'm not really sure I understand what an AA fundamentalist is. But if it's to love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with every fiber in your body, then I'm probably an AA fundamentalist. If it's to love the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and the message contained therein with all your heart, then I'm probably an AA fundamentalist. If it's to love your God as you understand Him with all your heart and soul, then I'm probably an AA fundamentalist. Because you see, that's why I'm here tonight. Because of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and the message contained therein, and because of my God as I understand Him, I'm allowed to stand here tonight and be able to tell a little bit of my story. I'm going to talk just a little bit about my first drunk, very little about the in-between drunks. You all know how to drink. I don't need to tell you how to do that. And a little bit about my last drunk. I know as a kid, like so many of us in AA, when I grew up as a teenager, I was always on the outside of the crowd looking in. Never felt that I fit anywhere I went. Always knew that whatever I said, whatever I did would be a mistake. People would laugh at me and I would be embarrassed. Had an awful hard time talking to girls. Didn't have nerve enough to ask one to dance with her. And couldn't do so many of the things that other teenagers seemed to be able to do reasonably easy. I shall never forget one night when I was 14 years old. At a high school dance in an old dairy barn out in the country. The upstairs part where the hay was stored had been converted into a dance floor. Bottom part where the cows used to be milked, the stanchions had been converted into places where you could sit down, tables and booths. And that night I was in that dance, standing against the wall upstairs, watching kids dance. A little girl named Betty that I knew was dancing. And I'd always wanted to talk to Betty and try to do something with Betty. But I always knew that if I said anything to her, she would refuse me and she would laugh and I would be embarrassed. And as the kids were dancing, I said to myself, as soon as the music stops, I'm going to walk over there and ask Betty to dance with me. And the music stopped and I began to walk toward Betty. And as I did, my mind began to say such things as, "What are you going to do if she says no? And the other kids will hear and they'll all laugh and you'll be embarrassed." And my footsteps got slower and slower. And my mind said such things as, "What are you going to do if she says yes? And you step on her toes and stumble and fall. And the other kids will laugh and you'll be embarrassed." And my footsteps got slower and slower. And before I could get to Betty, the music started and some other guy grabbed her and they started dancing together. And I went back over against the wall and I stood there and watched them dance. And I said to myself, as soon as the music stops, I'm going to ask Betty to dance. And a big, tall, slender guy I knew came sidling up to me, and he said, "Charlie, how would you like to go outside with me and have a drink of moonshine?" Well, I didn't know what moonshine was, but I was afraid that if I didn't say yes, other kids would hear me, and they would laugh, and I would be embarrassed. So I said, "Sure, I'd like to do that." So we went outside, and he opened up the trunk of his car, and he got out a quart jar of moonshine, and he took a drink, and he handed it to me, and I took a drink. And it seemed as though as that stuff passed over my lips got a tingling, exciting feeling. And as it hit my teeth, they kind of chattered up and down. And it hit my tongue, and I could feel it begin to grow and expand and swell. And it hit my cheeks, and they kind of fluttered in and out. And at the same time, I could feel it passing up through my sinus cavities into my forehead, and I got a feeling in my forehead which was absolutely indescribably wonderful. Well, I haven't even swallowed it yet. I've just got it in my mouth. And as I swallowed that stuff and it went down through my esophagus, great things began to happen. I could feel my chest begin to grow and expand and get bigger and bigger. It hit my stomach and it just literally exploded like a bomb. And I could feel it racing through my arms and they got longer and longer. And it hit my fingers and they began to tingle and vibrate. And at the same time, it was racing through my legs and I got taller and taller. And as it hit my bottom of my feet and my toes, they got a hot, intense, burning, exciting, get up and go somewhere and do something feeling. And this guy looked at me and he said, "Would you like to have another drink?" And from the tremendous height I'd already grown to, I looked down on his head and I said, "Yes, I believe I'll have one more of those." And I took a second drink and we went upstairs and I stood back against the wall and the music was playing and the kids were dancing. And I said to myself, as soon as this music stops, I'm going to go ask Betty to dance with me. And the music stopped, and I began to walk toward Betty. Now, this time my mind did not say, "What are you going to do if she says no?" Because I knew that she was going to say yes beyond any shadow of a doubt. And my mind didn't say, "What are you going to do if she says yes and you step on her toes and stumble and fall?" Because I knew that I'd be able to dance with Betty and everything would be all right. And I marched right up to her and I said, "Betty, how would you like to dance with me?" And she said, "Why, yeah, fine, great." And the music started and Betty and I began to dance. And sure enough, I didn't stumble and fall and I didn't step on her toes. In fact, I did quite well. And as the music came to an end, I said, "Betty, how would you like to dance with me again?" And she said, "Why, sure, great, Charlie." She said, "I didn't know you could dance." And I said, "I didn't either until just now." And to the best of my recollection, I danced with Betty every dance for the rest of the evening. And as the dance drew to a close, I began to find myself saying things I'd never been able to say before. I said, "Betty, how about taking you home from the dance?" She said, "Well, yeah, that'd be all right." Now, I didn't have a car to take her home in, but I knew a guy that had one, and he was a long, tall, slender fella, and he had a quart of moonshine in the trunk of his car. And I asked him if Betty and I could ride with he and his girl and we'd take Betty home. And he said, "Well, sure, come on, let's go." So we go outside and we get the quart of moonshine out of the trunk. We set it in the rear seat of the car. Betty and I get in the rear. He and his girlfriend get in the front and we start tooling it down the highway. And as we're riding down the highway, my mind said, "You know, you've asked this girl to dance with her and you did okay. And you've asked her to take her home and she said, all right." And I said, "I wonder what she'd do if I would put my arm around her and pull her over against my shoulder." Now, this is a hell of a momentous decision for a 14-year-old boy who's never been able to do this before. And as we rode along and I thought about that, I decided I'd do that. So I reached over and put my arm around Betty and pulled her over against my shoulder. And she just laid her head on my shoulder and looked up at me like they do, you know, with those beautiful eyes. And I thought, now, man, this is really living it up. And as we rode a little further, my mind began to say such things as, "You've asked her to dance, and she said, all right, and you're taking her home, and you got her head on her shoulder. I wonder what she would do if I would kiss her." Well, I'd never kissed a girl before, and I really didn't know how to go about it, but I knew from watching the movies that if you're going to kiss them, you got to have their head in just the right position. So as I decided to kiss her, I reached over and got her by the chin and got her face fixed just right. I knew that you're supposed to close your eyes as you kiss them. So as I leaned down to put my lips on hers, I closed my eyes, and I really don't know what I expected. I thought maybe she would slap my face, but you know, she didn't slap my face. She acted as though she rather enjoyed it. And her little lips began to move, and my little lips began to move, and we began to feel some form of electricity passing back and forth between us. And I thought, now, man, this really is living it up. For the first time, I'd been able to kiss a girl. And as we rode a little further, my mind began to think again, and it said, you're dancing with her, and you're taking her home, and you got her head on your shoulder, and you've kissed her, and she didn't slap your face. And I said, I wonder what she would do if I would reach over and get hold of one of those things. Well, now, I didn't know any more about getting hold of one of those things than I did about kissing them. But I knew that if you were going to get hold of one of them, you needed to be kissing them at the same time. So again, I reached over and I got her chin just right. And I leaned down to put my lips on hers, but this time I didn't shut my eyes because I wanted to see what my right hand was getting ready to do. And as I kissed her out of the corner of my eye, I saw my right hand reach over and get hold of one of those things. Now let me tell you something. If you're a little short 14-year-old kid that was rather chubby at that time and always seemed to wear these glasses, and you get one of those things in your hand for the first time, there's just no way you can describe that feeling. I knew I'd never felt anything like that before. And I'm not so damn sure I've ever felt anything like that since then either. I get to thinking about that today, and my old hand just gets to jumping and jerking. And as I look back on it now, I fully realize that was my first spiritual experience. Alcohol did for me that night what I could not do for myself. Alcohol became the answer to my problems. I believe tonight that my mind that night became obsessed with the idea of drinking alcohol. Now, there really isn't anything too difficult to understand about an obsession of the mind. An obsession of the mind is nothing more than an idea that overcomes all ideas. And as I began to grow up a little older and continue to drink alcohol, I began to experience some difficulties with it, begin to get drunk more than I wanted to, and begin to get into some troubles with it. And my mother said to me one day, she said, son, I need to talk to you about your drinking. She said, don't you know you have an uncle in an insane asylum in the state of California? He's there as a wet brain due to alcohol. And she said, if you continue to drink the way you are, someday you're going to be there too. And I said, oh, Mama, you don't understand. I'm different than my uncle. And if it ever begins to give me that kind of trouble, I'll stop drinking. You see, my mother could see the truth about my drinking then, but I couldn't see that. And one day when I was about 17 years old, my dad said to me, son, I need to talk to you about your drinking. He said, every member of the Parmley family that's ever tried to drink alcohol has experienced trouble with it. And he said, I had trouble with it, my brothers had trouble with it, my sisters had trouble with it. And he said, if you continue to drink alcohol like you are, eventually you'll destroy your life. And I said, oh, Dad, you don't understand. I'm not like the rest of the Parmleys. If I ever have trouble with it, I'll stop drinking. You see, my dad could see the truth about alcohol then. I couldn't see the truth about it at all. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous tells us that we cannot differentiate the truth from the false. And I couldn't when I was 17 years old. When I was about 18 years old in the service in northern Germany, I woke up in an army hospital one day and there was a doctor standing by the side of my bed, and he looked at me and he said, son, I need to talk to you about your drinking. He said, you've been laying in this hospital for 3 days. He said, you've already died twice. And he said, if you continue to drink alcohol as you're drinking it, you'll never live to be 30 years old. And I said, doctor, you don't understand. If I ever have that kind of trouble with alcohol, I'll stop drinking. When I was 21 years old, I'd married a beautiful lady named Maxine. And we'd been married about 6 months. And she said to me one night, she said, Charlie, I need to talk to you about your drinking. She said, I don't know what you're doing or where you're going, but you're drinking too much. You're laying out at night. She said, you're a fine man and I love you dearly. But if you continue to drink the way you're drinking, sooner or later, I'll have to divorce you. And I said, oh, honey, you don't understand. If alcohol ever creates a serious problem in our marriage, I'll stop drinking. Don't worry about that. When I was about 30 years old, my boss called me in the office one day, and he said, "Charlie, you're a fine employee." He said, "You're one of the best we've got. You do a great job." And he said, "I don't know whether you know it or not, but you're slated to take my job when I retire in 2 years. But," he said, "I need to talk to you about your drinking." He said, "I don't know where you're going at night and what you're doing, but it's beginning to interfere with your work. You're coming in the mornings, you look hungover. Some mornings I believe I can smell alcohol on you." And he said, "If you don't stop drinking the way you are, sooner or later we'll have to fire you." And I said, "Oh, boss, don't worry about that. If alcohol gets to be a serious trouble on my job, I'll quit drinking." All of these people could see the truth about my alcoholism, but I couldn't see that. I really could not differentiate the truth from the false, because alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. Some 26 years after I took that first drink in that old barn dance that night, I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had lost that beautiful wife. I had lost that wonderful job. I was in the process of losing a second wife, 3 beautiful stepchildren, and 1 little blue-eyed, blonde-haired daughter of my own. And I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous only because my wife of that time had gone to Al-Anon. And she had learned in Al-Anon that I had a disease and I wasn't drinking the way I was drinking just because I wanted to, but because I was sick. And rather than divorce me, she had decided that we should try to live together and work these things out. And she made one condition, that I at least go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and see if maybe I could find an answer there. I went to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Friday night meeting in a little town called Siloam Springs, Arkansas. And there they have a group called the Borderline Group. Now, for a while, I thought that meant borderline alcoholics, but today I realize it's because it's on the Oklahoma-Arkansas border. And I went to that meeting on Friday night not knowing I was alcoholic, not knowing I had an allergy to alcohol, not knowing that I had an obsession of the mind that could not differentiate the true from the false, knowing only there was a problem in my life. And I thought that maybe the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous would first teach me a way to drink without getting drunk. And if they couldn't teach me that, then surely they could show me how to get my wife off my back. I came here for 2 reasons. Number 1, to learn how to drink without getting drunk. And number 2, to get my wife off my back. Little did I know that the Fellowship would sell me on the idea of sobriety. Little did I know that this sneaky fellowship would take me into a book which would sell me on the idea of God as I understand Him. You see, I didn't come here to find God. I came here to get out of a problem. And I walked in the door in Siloam Springs, Arkansas on that Friday night, and they all stood up and they stuck out their hands and they said, "Hello, Charlie, how are you?" They said, "Man, we're glad to see you. Have you been having a little trouble with alcohol?" And I said, "Yes, I have. And I guess the reason I'm here is to find out what to do about it." And they proceeded to tell me. One of the older members said, "We believe as a new member," and he said, "it's not a bad idea for old members, that you need to go to 4 or 5 or 6 AA meetings a week." He said, "You need to go as much as you can to have the companionship and the sharing of the experience and strength of the older members who are sober." Another one handed me the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, "We call this the big book," and he said, "if you will read it and study it, you will find the answers to the disease of alcoholism, and you can stay sober if you want to." And another old bald-headed poot, and you see them at every AA meeting, I see 1 or 2 here tonight, in addition to these sitting here by me, he said, "Son," and I was a lot younger in those days, he said, "Son, someday you're going to have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him if you want to stay sober." And I told these fine people, "I don't believe I can do those things." I said, "After all, I've got a farm out here. I raise 45,000 chickens. I've got 100 head of cattle. I've got a 500 hog feeder operation. I've got a red-headed wife, 4 kids, and 2 bird dogs. And if you're going to take care of all that, you're going to have to stay home and get your rest. I said, there's no way I can go to 4, 5, or 6 AA meetings a week. I took the big book and I read it. I went to How It Works, and I read the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I almost vomited. I said, I don't believe I can do these things that it asked me to do. And the old bald-headed poot, I kind of looked at him and said, you don't need to tell me anything about God. I already know about God, because I was born and raised in a good Southern Baptist church. And I knew about hellfire and brimstone and going to hell for lying, cheating, stealing, drinking whiskey, and committing adultery. And by the time I got to AA, I'd had about 26 years of doing that. And I said, God's not going to have anything to do with me. And I said, I can't do these things you're asking me to do, but I said, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to come to your meetings religiously every Friday night here in Siloam Springs, and I'm going to work this program the way I want to, and I'm going to stay sober, and if you don't believe me, you watch me. I'm getting ready to do exactly that. And they looked at me, and they grinned, and they said, keep coming back. Thank God for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Any other fellowship in the world would have taken an arrogant, overbearing SOB like me and thrown him right out the door, and they just said, keep coming back. And I went to their meetings, and I didn't miss a Friday night, and as weeks went by, I got sicker and sicker and sicker. And at the end of about 90 days, I didn't feel good, and I wanted to feel better, and I didn't know but one way to feel better, and that was to drink. And I'd been hearing those people talking about having slips, and I decided it was time for me to have one. So I took a drink, and unbeknownst to me, I triggered this allergy, and I ended up drunk, sick, and in all kinds of trouble. 3 or 4 weeks later, I came back to AA, and I walked in the door at that meeting on Friday night, and there they all stood, hands sticking out, and they said, hello, Charlie, how are you? They said, man, we're glad to see you back. They said, you've been having a little trouble with alcohol. And I said, yes, I have. And I guess the reason I'm here is to find out what to do about it. And they proceeded to tell me. One of them said, you need to go to 4, 5, 6 AA meetings a week. One said, read and study the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And the old bald-headed poot said, son, someday you'll have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him if you want to stay sober. And these people still didn't understand me. You know, and it was impossible for me to do those things. And as I look back now, I know it was, and I know the reason why is because I had never been defeated yet in my life. And I said, but I'll come to your meetings, and I'll work this program the way I want to, and I'll stay sober. And if you don't believe me, you watch me. I'm getting ready to do exactly that. And they said, keep coming back. And I went to the meetings every Friday night religiously, never missed a meeting. And about 6 months later, I felt worse than I'd ever felt in my life. And I knew I had a choice. I could do one of two things. I could take a gun and I could blow my brains out, or I could take a drink. And I opted for the easier, softer way, and I took a drink. And I ended up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. And it took me a hell of a long time to get off of it that time, but finally I did, and I came back to AA. And I walked in the door on Friday night, and there they all stood. And their hands sticking out, and they said, hello, Charlie, how are you? They said, man, we're glad to see you back. You've been having a little trouble with alcohol. I said, yes, I have. And I guess I'm here to find out what to do about it. And they told me. One of them said, you need to go to 4, 5, 6 AA meetings a week. The other one said, if you'll take this damn book and read it, you'd be all right. And the old bald-headed man said, boy, he said, I'm getting tired telling you this. But if you want to stay sober, sooner or later, you're going to have to turn your life and your will over to the care of God as you understand him. And again, I could not do these things because I had not been defeated. You see, I'd been able to stop drinking by myself. I'd been able to stop drinking slowly over a period of time. I could taper off the vodka, get on the beer, and then over a period of days, taper off the beer, and then finally come back to AA. I had never been defeated in my life. So I said, I can't do those things, but I'll come to your meetings. And I'll work this program the way I want to, and by golly, I'll stay sober. And if you don't believe me, watch me. I'm getting ready to do it. And again, they grinned and said, keep coming back. 9 months later, life was worth nothing. 9 months later, I could get along with nobody or anything, not myself, not my neighbors, not my wife, not my kids, not my bird dogs, and not the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted to feel better, and I didn't know but one thing that would do that. The mind searching for that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I knew a drink would make me feel better. And I didn't want to take it, but I knew I had to take it, and I took it. And I got drunk, and I got in all kinds of trouble. This time, as I tried to taper off, the tapering off didn't work. I'd go to the liquor store, and I'd get a quart of vodka, and I'd get a case of beer, and I'd take it back home, and I'd try to drink the beer, and the beer would do nothing at all. It was just like drinking water. And as the days went by, I got sicker and sicker and sicker. And I finally got to where about all I could really do was just drink and pass out and wake up and sick and shaking and trembling and sweating and swearing I'd never take another drink as long as I live, and in 2 minutes having to have a drink. Barbara and the kids finally moved me into the utility room. And about 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 weeks later, Barbara stuck her head in the door one day and she said, "Honey, how are you doing?" And I said, "My God, I'm sick." She said, "Have you got anything to drink?" And I said, "No." She said, "I'll be right back." And about 30 minutes later, she came back and she had for me 12 half-pint bottles of vodka, all different flavors of it. And she said, "Here, you love this more than anything else." Now, for years, I thought she did that out of the goodness of her heart. Today, I realized she had already learned in Al-Anon, let the sucker get it on, and the faster he does, the better. He'll either sober up or he'll die, one of the two. And in a day or two, I had all of that vodka gone. And I woke up one morning knowing that I was dying from the disease of alcoholism. And I didn't want to die drunk. Still don't want to die drunk. And I sure didn't want to die drunk then. And I didn't know what I was going to do about that situation. You see, I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't drink coffee. I couldn't drink water. I couldn't even smoke cigarettes. All I could do was drink vodka and pass out and wake up 2 or 3 hours later and drink vodka and pass out. And I knew I was dying from the disease. And for the first time that I can remember, I asked another human being for help. I turned to my wife and I said, "I've got to have help." And she said, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "Call AA." And she called the guy that made the original 12-step deal with me and another fellow. And they came to my house and they took one look at me and one said to the other, "We got to take him to the hospital. If we try to sober him up, he's going to die sure as anything." And they looked at me and they said, "Charlie, let us clean you up and we'll put you in the hospital." And I said, "No." I said, "Boys, I don't think I'm that bad. I believe I can do this my way." And one turned to the other and said, "Well, we might as well leave because we can't help him unless he's ready." And as they walked out the door, one turned back to me with tears in his eyes, and he said, "Charlie, when you need me, call me." And 2 or 3 hours later, I knew I couldn't do it. And somehow I managed to get to the phone, and I called this fellow, and he came to my house. And when he got there, I was on the front porch trying to drink a can of beer, and about half of it was gone. And he said, "Bring your beer, and let's go." And I said, "No, I don't want any more beer." I said, "I've had it. I just can't stand it anymore." And he took me to the hospital, and there they gave me the proper medication to ward off the convulsions, the DTs. And 2 or 3 days later, I came to in that hospital. And I came to in a place I'd never been, not in my body, but in my mind. I came to in a place where I had been completely defeated. I understand what Bill Wilson said in the book when he said he woke up in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around him in all directions. Alcohol had become his master. Because that's exactly where I was that day. And I didn't know what to do about it. And my mind remembered that another older fellow in AA had said, "If you ever have a problem that you can't handle, try prayer and see what happens." And I remembered that. And I said to myself, "Why don't you pray?" And my mind said, "Oh, no, no, just weak people pray. Strong people that stand on their own 2 feet don't need to pray to any God they don't understand anyhow. And besides that, he's already condemned you to hell and he won't help you." And my mind said, "What are you going to do if you don't?" And I said, "I don't know, but I'm going to have to do something." And after a while, my mind said, "What would it hurt to try? There's not a soul in this room but you. Nobody would see you. And if it didn't work, it wouldn't hurt anything at all." And I'll never forget lying back in that bed, looking straight up at the ceiling, eyes wide open, and I uttered a false prayer. I said, "God, if there is a kind and a loving God, can you remove from me the obsession to drink alcohol?" I have no idea what happened. I didn't, as Bill did, feel like the clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. I have no idea what took place. But the instant I uttered that prayer, I knew I never had to take another drink as long as I lived, if I didn't want to. And I left in a hospital bed, and I went back to AA. And on Friday night, I walked in the meeting, and there they all stood with their hands sticking out, and they said, "Hello, Charlie, how are you?" They said, "Man, we're glad to see you back. You've been having a little trouble with alcohol." I said, "Yes, I have." And I didn't ask them what to do about it. And they didn't tell me what to do about it. I started going to 4, 5, 6 AA meetings a week. I began to read and study the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, starting with a doctor's opinion. I began to ask this God that I did not understand on a daily basis to give me one more day of sobriety. And I began to thank Him at night for one more day of sobriety. That has been 6,980 days ago today. And I haven't had to have a drink since then. Thank you all for letting me be here tonight.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charlie. Beautiful message. Beautiful message. This is the only fellowship they can't put you out. You declare yourself in. And when you're in, you're here. I can't imagine any other fellowship, as Charlie pointed out, where you can walk in the door and say, "I don't like none of you. I don't like your 12 steps. I don't even like that coffee you got down there. But I want to get sober, so I'm staying." This is our fellowship. Joe McHugh, I met when I was in Little Rock. That time also, he used to mistake me and Joe. I wonder why. But I remember Joe up in Burlington last year when we were up there at their big book study they put on up there. And the people, when Joe would talk and he would get up, I never forget the time Charlie and Joe were in the Bahamas and they were walking down the street together. and Joe looked at Charlie and said, "You notice all those people looking at us?" And Charlie said, "Yeah." And Joe said, "Well, they're looking at you this time." It's that kind of sense of humor and the love that we feel in our fellowship that makes Joe and Charlie so special. And without any further from me, I'd like to give you Joe P.
My name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic. Through God's grace, and because this program works one day at a time in my life, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol since March of 1962. For this, I'm grateful. I know a lot of other people are grateful, too. You know, this guy, Charlie, is getting to be a hard act to follow, man, I'll tell you. But I say I am an alcoholic, and they say we tell a little bit about when we talk about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And I love to talk about these facets of my life. I think, and I never get tired of it, talking about the wonders of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. What did happen in my life? I think that's the key thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, not what we were like so much. Is we got to identify and talk about that to a certain extent. But what did happen in our lives? The miracle of our recovery. You know, a gift handed down that has changed so many lives. This is the power of our fellowship. And I also, we need to talk a little bit about how it is now. And I like to talk about sometimes the wonders of my life today. It is amazing. But I'm like Charlie, I guess, you know, I say I'm a real alcoholic. And people say, "What's that?" I say, "Well, you know, I guess I always was an alcoholic. I'm a thoroughbred alcoholic." You know, I wonder about my life. If I had never been an alcoholic, I never would have amounted to nothing. You know, that's the main thing of my life. I'm an alcoholic. My whole life is based on it. But I was sort of like Charlie. I probably was one of those, you know, I think some people, as we see this disease of alcoholism, become alcoholics gradually over a period of time, drank for a period of time. My book says they start off as a moderate drinker, may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. Somewhere along the drink way, they lose control. And I think, too, I was like Charlie. I was one of these people that was an alcoholic from the very beginning. And I was sort of like, like them instant potatoes. When you pour the water on them, you got it, you know. Soon as booze got on me. But I came from a great family. I was a poor family. But we didn't know we were poor then. Everybody was poor. You know, they hadn't drawn the line yet when I was, that poverty line. I always say that we grew up in a poor neighborhood and had plenty to eat. I know we had plenty to eat because every time I asked my mother for some more, she said, "You've already had a plenty." So I guess I had plenty to eat. But I was finally induced to alcohol when I was about 18 years old. And I remember the occasion like Charlie does. I remember the people I was with. I remember the night, and I remember the situation of my first drink. Now, that is not a, prerequisite to being an alcoholic. But I wonder about that. I didn't remember my first Coca-Cola or my first banana split, but I remember my first drink. And so it had some impact on my life. And I began to drink. And I know, and thank God, I never knew my problem. I never understood. And I think that's why we are so blessed to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We take this for granted. We take this for granted. But I feel blessed as an alcoholic. Because, most alcoholics in our country and in the world today are going to die never knowing they were alcoholics. We are the only alcoholics in the world. Only the members of Alcoholics Anonymous are the only alcoholics in the world. The only people who know they're alcoholics. Most alcoholics are going to die never knowing they were alcoholics. We have been blessed. For some reason or other, God has given us not only the fellowship, but given us the opportunity to be a part of this. And I didn't know, there's this time in my life, I had a problem and didn't know it. They didn't know I had it. And that's all the first step is. It says you're powerless over alcohol, your life has become unmanageable. But somewhere along the line, and I was powerless over alcohol probably from the very beginning, from that very night. But little did I know this. I had to come to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous many years later. So I went through the trial and tribulations of dealing with a problem that I didn't know I had, that I didn't understand. And I drank and I got into a lot of trouble. Man, I got, some people, they say practice makes perfect. Oh, the more I drank, the worse I got. I never could drink. I just never could drink. Constant trouble. Got married and had a young family, got divorced. And I was back home with my father and I was about 25 years old. That's the way drunks do. They always get, I was a type of drunk, and most alcoholics that way. I always got interested in my family when I got broke. I didn't, every time I got broke, I said, "You ought to go see your father," And I always hung around my family. And of course, my father, he was a little, God bless him, he lived to see me find a good life in Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years before he died. I believe he was 86 years old. But in those days, he was up in age. But he would always, Charlie and I, he was sharp old little guy. He would always lend me some money to leave town. I couldn't borrow none as long as I was there. And so I would make these tours in and out of my home. It was on one of these times that I came to Arkansas, and this has been over 30 years ago. I mean, 30 years ago now. Around 30 years ago. Now I feel that I'm here tonight in Alcoholics Anonymous with a life that is unbelievable. My life is unbelievable to a person like me from where I came. I found a way of living that I didn't know existed. And tonight I know just a little bit about heaven. I think God took an interest in my life 30 years ago because he loved me, because I was in trouble. And I had gotten into trouble there and I had run through a marriage and I probably couldn't hold a job too good at that time. And my life was in all kind of shambles, but I didn't see it. And so I came to Little Rock. I decided that the way I got in Little Rock, it wasn't, I had a sister that lived there. And I hadn't seen her for about 6 or 7 years. She had went off to go to college down there. And so I didn't want to embarrass going back to my father anymore. So I thought about my sister. I said, "You haven't seen your sister for 6 or 7 years. That's not right. You ought to go see your sister." So this is the way I came to Little Rock about 30 years ago. And I got there just like I remember that night. Now, my life is, you know, Little Rock is my life. I go all over the world, but that's where I'm supposed to be. And I think all of us, you know, God created us for a purpose. Everybody's created for a purpose. I think God didn't create nobody for no reason. And I think that the happiest an individual is ever going to be is fulfill his purpose for being here. And I feel like this is my life. My life, I work with alcoholics. I run a little treatment center there that I started many years ago. And this is my life and my purpose. And I feel like that's the purpose of my becoming alcoholic. That's the purpose of my recovery. It's allowed me to do the things in this world that God wants me to do. But it didn't seem like the beginning of a purpose 30 years ago when I got off that Greyhound bus broke. And I had $4 in my pocket when I got to Little Rock. And I had one of those drunk suitcases. I don't know if any of y'all have seen the drunk suitcases. They're little small ones. And they just have one latch on them. And you tie a necktie around the other end. And that's a drunk suitcase. They still make them like that for alcoholics. I see them coming into treatment centers every day with drunk suitcases. Not so long ago, I had one guy check in the treatment center, and the guy said, "Joe, this guy never make it." I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "He's got alligator luggage." Man, you can't get sober with alligator luggage. But anyway, I had $4 in my pocket, and I got there. I could always get a job. I had several professions, you know. Any good real alcoholic needs several professions. I didn't need training when I got here. I needed untraining. But, yeah, I went to work, and I was living with my sister. Now, you have to know she's a very religious person, still is today. She's a beautiful person, but she's been that way all her life. She's involved in the church. Her husband was a lay speaker in our church. Today, he's a pastor of one of our larger United Methodist churches there. And these were fine young people at that time. And, you know, that's a tough place for a drunk to be around them kind of people. They go into church, and you trying to lay in there from Saturday night. And so one morning, they invited me to go to church. So I felt kind of threatened. So I went to church with them. And here's where I met Lou Bell. My, you know, Charlie and I said both our Al-9s are black belt Al-9s, and ours really are. But, you know, here's where I met Lou Bell at church that Sunday morning, and she's a part of my recovery. She's a part of my life. I don't know where I'd be today without having her to come into my life at that time. Because it was just me. I didn't care. But things, we met there at the church, and I always talked that morning about how we met. You know, I had a good, now she was a good friend of my sister. She was in the choir. My sister was an organist, and Lou Bell was in the choir. So we met there at the church that morning, and I know I had a good front, because I had the organist and the lay preacher. That's a good camouflage. So Lou Bell and I met there at church that morning, and you know how we alcoholics operate, by selling fast conversation to those slow-thinking ladies. And I give her my best job that morning, and we got married in about 3 months. Now, she hasn't recovered from this yet. She still talks about it. She hasn't recovered from it. But you'd have to look at the situation. See, I'm still working out this little raggedy suitcase and staying with my sister. I got it, barely got a job. Now, Lou Bell's got, had been married before and divorced, so she had a little home, the same home we live in now. And she had a new car and a good job. And I thoroughly convinced her how she needed me to take care of her.
Boy, the best job I ever did.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your cassette over at this time for side two.
And we got married very shortly. And, you know, we had to take a honeymoon. She couldn't go, but, you know, I took... I did a little honeymoon. I stocked in a good supply of booze. and stayed home and did a little honeymoon in there by myself. Like I say, I was a go-getter. I took her to work and went and got her. But, you know. But after about a week of honeymooning there by myself, I remember it didn't take about 3 or 4 days for her to figure out what she had. But anyway, after about a week of drinking there, I made my first trip to the old state hospital. Now, that was the old, you know, back in our part of the country, and that was, you know, it's just like in a big book. It was near the end of that time. These things would have changed. But in the 60s, they still had the insane asylums for alcoholics. And this is where I drank myself into the Arkansas Insane Asylum. And I, you know, they didn't do me any good. And I think today about, they didn't have anything. They didn't even have an AA meeting in there. They never mentioned alcoholism. They just give you some of that Othorazine, and we shuffled around for a few days. And they dried you out the best you can, and just nothing, you know. And I got out of there, and I continued to drink and went through a lot of things in my life. But we didn't have any marriage, and I become a traveling drunk. I ended up in Kansas City about a year later after I got out of that hospital, and I had a job, and I was a waiter, and I worked around clubs, and I could always work and make some money and drink. And I drank myself down, and I was in pretty bad shape up there, but I was able to work. And one morning I got up and I needed to drink. I went down to the local bar. And it was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I went into this bar, and these winos was in there trying to get 40 cents together to get a pint of wine. And I had $4. And I told him, that's okay, I'll buy. It was 60 cents, I believe. I'll buy. So I bought a pint of wine, and me and two winos, the girl would pour it up in glasses. They wouldn't give the winos the bottles down there on 12th and Vine in Kansas City. And as she poured the wine in the glasses, all the winos would get down and look at the glasses and see if they were level. They would check out the barmaid. Now, she was good at pouring them, but finally they'd hold a meeting, you know, and have a big discussion. And they would finally decide that one glass did have a hair more than the other. They would all agree on a two-thirds vote. Okay. And then they would give that to the man who bought. Class, man, them classy people. So that morning, you know, we were standing there, and I was drinking, helping my fellow man. And as we was drinking, a little guy named Van, he said, Joe, he said, you know, you're a pretty nice guy. I've been knowing that, you know. And he said, you're a lot different from me, and you're a lot different from the rest of the guys down here on the street. Well, I knew I wasn't like him. He was a dirty wino. He said, but Joe, you got one problem. I said, what's that, Van? He said, Joe, you're drinking too much. You know, God chooses all kinds of people. You know, this is what's so proud of my life. I listen to all people. It's not the high and the almighty. God speaks to me today through the most insignificant people. You know, even yet today, it amazes me how God uses so many dumb people to talk to me. You know, he really does. But I heard Van, and I had talked to a lot of people, but for some reason or another, I heard Van. Maybe because if Van had a problem, Van looked like a man who knew what he was talking about. And I left that place, and for some reason or another, it got to me. I said, well, you know, I didn't understand my problem, but I thought I did. You know, Van, you know, I said, well, maybe I have. This is my problem, drinking. Now, if your problem is drinking, that was just part of my problem. My main problem was not drinking. Our book tells us different. But at that time, I thought it was drinking. I see a lot of people who say their problem was drinking. If your problem is drinking, all you got to do is quit, right? Yes, easy. But my problem was not drinking. And my problem was not quitting. My problem was starting. I couldn't stop starting. I could quit. But I didn't know how to stop starting. And I quit. But I started up again about 9 months later, and I was in trouble. On March 10th, 1962, I came to that point, and I love it in the big book. You know, when Bill talks about that, as Charlie talked about it, I know that feeling. Well, you know, when quicksand stretched it all around us, I had met my match. Alcohol was a master. I hadn't had that morning. I was sitting on a bar, March 10, 1962. I was sitting on a bar, and I felt it. I wasn't nowhere else to go. Wasn't no more lies to tell. That was it. I had been totally defeated. And all I said, it wasn't really a prayer. It wasn't a prayer to God. I don't think you have to find God. I think what you have to do in this program is get up on yourself, and God will be there. And I just gave up on myself that morning. I said, I can't go on like this. The next moment, I had some stupid idea about going back to this insane asylum. See, that's the only thing I knew was help with this place. Now, I swore for 2 years I'd never go back there, and if you were there, you would have sworn the same thing. This wasn't, you know, nobody, people talking about going to detox center 10 times. Boy, if you went there 3 times, they'd lock you up permanently. You had to be something wrong with you. So I got off the bar and called a cab, and I had $2.50 in my pocket. And the guy charged me $2, almost $1.95. And I went out there and checked in on the morning of March 10th, 1962. Little did I know that was my last drink. You know, I remember back in those days when you went into the mental institutions, they weren't like the treatment centers of the day. Most of the people in the hospital, they were mental hospitals. They had been there for years. There was one guy had been there, was 36, and had been there since he was 6 years old. It was people that had been there for 20, 15 and 20 years. And we alcoholics would go and stay 30 days, but we'd be locked up with the regular mental people that was on our wards. And this is a tough place to sober up. If you ever try to sober up and try to watch 65 crazy people at the same time, you know, you come off of a bad drunk and watching these people and they doing everything, boy, I'm telling you, man, it was tough. But when you went into these places, people didn't talk to you too much. You know how you go into a mental institution, they wouldn't. Now, they had some alcoholics in there. But when the alcoholics wouldn't talk to the new people that was admitted. Now, this is the only place I ever been in my life where alcoholism was a status symbol. See, the alcoholics were the class of the ward. See, all the mental people saw the alcoholics come and go. The AIDS would give us stuff. The AIDS would give us presser privileges. The AIDS would talk to the alcoholics. The AIDS wouldn't have anything to do with these mental people. They never had any visitors. We had visitors. So we were the class of the ward. And when you ask one of them mental people what he was doing in there, all of them would say, oh, I'm an alcoholic. See, they wanted to be alcoholic. And when you ask one of us alcoholics, what are you in here for? We said, we got nervous breakdowns, you know, so you couldn't tell who was who. But so I went in there. I didn't use that word alcoholic. You know, we don't use that. I said, I'm in here for drinking. So Saturday I came in, Sunday, and Monday morning, God bless him, a great little guy came into my life. Not a learned man, not an alcoholism counselor, not a great professional. God brought a man named Ora into my life. Ora was a had two, he, you know, and Ora was good enough for me. I love the works of Paul. Paul says God's grace is sufficient. No, God is just enough. Ora was good enough for me. Ora had 2 weeks of locked up sobriety, the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, and a carton of Camel cigarettes. Now, no one on this ward had a ready roll. And this guy happened to have a carton of Campbell's. And I had got there, I bought one pack, and I was busted. And they'd give me some of that roll your own tobacco. and I never rolled a cigarette in my life, coming off a drunk, shaking, and I'm here, man, I wanted one so I would roll and it wouldn't stick together and it would flame all up and fall down. And you know, that is awful. And here's this guy, got a whole carton of Camels, talking about your life being unmanageable. I don't have no trouble with that. The only way I could smoke was take my tobacco and paper and give it to one of them nuts and let him roll it and lick it and give it back to me. Now, you know, you ain't operating too good. And this guy has got a whole carton of Camels. So I sat down, and he lets me smoke his cigarettes. And finally, he said, "You want to borrow a pack?" And he opens this big book. And for years, I used to say, we discussed the big book. Aura didn't know one thing about the big book. I didn't either. Didn't know one thing. But he would have it in his hand. And he and I, thank God that some people were living the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was two men that came to our ward, you know, some real alcoholics. And Aura would sit there and tell me about these people, these AA people, for 3 days. He told me about it all day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. He talked about these guys and what they said. And I thank God that tonight that some people were living the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. These people had to be living. My life was saved by a living message of Alcoholics Anonymous. They came into that ward, and Aura talked about it. And I went out to my first AA meeting that Wednesday night. And that's been over almost 26 years ago. Because a little guy gave me cigarettes. Because he told me about these AA people. And he said, they are going to bring a pot of coffee, and they'll bring 3 packs of cigarettes and open them and lay on the table for us. Will you go? And I went to my first AA meeting because he told me these people were going to bring some coffee and they was going to have some ready roll cigarettes. And I went out there for a cup of coffee and a cigarette. And God gave me a brand new way of living. See, I got a way of living that I never knew existed. And tonight I know a little bit about heaven. And all I wanted out of this whole deal was a cup of coffee and a cigarette. We talk about the grace of God, a gift unwarranted. And I met some real alcoholics. I always say, thank God he sent enough to send the very best. He didn't send no chumps out there. He sent some real alcoholics. And one of them became my sponsor and still is today. This guy had been locked up too. He had come out of the penitentiary. And he had been out about 10 years. And he came out of the penitentiary, and he had been locked up since he was 14 years old, and he got out when he was 38. He had been out one time for 6 years. And he got out of the prison, and he had 105 years paroled against him. He had been sober 10 years when he found me locked up. And he brought me the message. And that night he talked. I hope he's doing like I did. He got up and told how it was, and I said, God, man. I knew all about AA. You know how alcoholics are. I knew they meddled in your business, the do-gooders. I figured there was a bunch of do-gooders. And I said, if they mess with me, I'm going to tell them off. But this guy didn't talk about me. He got up there and talked about himself. In fact, I was mad he didn't offend me that night. So he was standing over there by the wall, and as soon as the meeting was over, I went over there and did just like the book says. The book says, let him ask you. And I really did that night. I went over there and I said, Charles, I hear what you said about your life, but what do you think I should do? And I remember he looked at me with a big smile, just like he still does today. He looked down on me and he said, fella, I was telling you what I did. I said, what do you think I should do? He said, Frank, I don't give a damn what you do. He said, that's your business. He said, that's your business. He said, but then he said, if you want me to show you, I will show you what I did, if you want it. And he got my attention. You know, this is he has, you know, 35, 36 years in the program today. Our lives have completely changed, and I began this journey to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this was in 1962, and I guess, I don't know if y'all, some young people don't remember, but there were some changes taking place in this country in 1962 as far as race was concerned. And Little Rock, Arkansas was involved in that. And this wasn't the best place to be the first black coming into AA at this time. You know, I always do things at the wrong time. And they had this little old dormitory where Charles went to his meetings, and it was a place where some men stayed that, it was a forerunner of treatment centers, but it was a 20-bed, 25 people there. And they wouldn't let me stay there, but they would let me come to the meetings at 7 o'clock every morning. And that was his meeting. He said, "You're meeting me there." And that's where we went, 7 o'clock every morning, except Sunday morning. And, you know, they would, I would go, and I think about Charles. You know, for many years I didn't think about, you know, I thought about my situation. What things I had to go through to get into Alcoholics Anonymous, but I think about the things Charles did. You know, his AA way of life was threatened because of me, but he carried me, and he stuck beside me. I could go to AA meetings, they tell me, "You can come to the meetings, but you can't drink coffee, and you can't hang around. As soon as the meeting's over, you have to leave." But he says, you be here. And I would be there. I came back, I always say, because I had a ticket for this thing. You know, that's what I see a lot of people. You know, the only thing you got to have to get in this thing is desire to stop drinking, and that's a ticket. And if you got a desire to stop drinking, they got to let you in. And if you ain't got it, they can't keep you in here. I see a lot of people around AA ain't got a ticket. You know, that if you go out there and drink enough booze, they'll give you a ticket. If you can, they'll give you a desire to stop drinking. So I had a desire to stop drinking, so I came. And I stayed. And I began to work the program. And I did, because we didn't know in those days. They told you. That's one thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, the great change. That I had an opportunity, I think some of the young people is changing today. AA has grown so. It is, you know, we have gotten, at that time we didn't have but really two groups in Little Rock. And when you went to Alcoholics Anonymous then, in those days, two little groups, most people in AA knew everybody that was in AA because it wasn't that many people. And when you walk into Alcoholics Anonymous in those days, what has happened, they knew you was new. Everybody there knew you was new. And about half of the people at that meeting on your very first night would walk up to you and tell you, "Young man, this is what you got to do." They would tell you. The first night, and continues to tell you. But nowadays, today, we have grown so big, we got so many meetings. You can go to AA, and they don't know whether you're from another group, or whether you're new, or where you come from. You can just get lost, and nobody never tells you nothing. You know what I mean? But in those days, they would tell you what you had to do. And, you know, I was kind of dumb. I didn't know you couldn't do it. I mean, yeah. You know, you go somewhere new with something, they tell you what to do, you usually do it. So I began to do this. And my life began to change. We took the step. We wrote the inventory. And my life began to change. I think about, to share how it is now, not to leave bad taste or some ideas of what my life was about. But you know, the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, some years later, I was the first black in AA, and I went through this. And after a while, I began to work with alcoholics myself. I began to go to the county penal farm after I was sober a year, and I began to do work around this little place where I was wasn't allowed to go to meetings, and it grew. And finally, I had another job, but I did volunteer work and sponsored guys around the old club where we had 20 guys living. After about 5 or 6 years, I was appointed on the board of directors of the facility there and worked around that little facility for quite a few years. And in the last part of, I began to work at different alcoholics in all over the state. And finally, in the late 60s, I became involved with the state government in setting up the, served on the ad hoc committee to set up of alcohol and drug programs in the state of Arkansas, and served on that for 4 or 5 years through a governor's appointment, and then was appointed to the state authority and served on that for about 8 years. And then after the last 4 years, I served as chairman of that authority, which controls all the alcohol and drug programs in the state of Arkansas. Now, that's peculiar, you know, that I could, that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that opportunity in my life to perform a service for my state, to perform a service for people in treatment, which I still work with today extensively. And 26 years ago, I couldn't even stay in one of them. 26 years ago, they would let me drink a cup of coffee. But still, God has allowed me to be a part of this and to be a service to the people in my state, to be a service to the people in, that need help in the field of, in recovering from the disease of alcoholism. And this has been my life. This is my life today, and I have the opportunities now to work with prisons all over the country, in Texas and Georgia and North Carolina and Arkansas, and to give something back in that area of the guy who came out of prison and helped me 20-some years ago. And this has been a great part of my life. My life is truly unbelievable. And as I close, you know, I think there are many miracles in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think miracle is simply getting what you need when you need it. And I truly, you know, stay in constant anticipation of miracles in my life every day in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, and God bless you.